Blog Talk.
Everybody, welcome to another great episode we have here at Suspense Radio. I'm your host, John Robb, and today we have a great show for you. 90 minutes, three authors. We're going to kick it off here in just a second with author Mary Jane Clark to talk about her latest book in the Wedding Cake Mystery Series. And then William Beck is going to be on, and we're going to end it with author Kevin O'Brien. So we got a lot of stuff to cover, audio stuff going on, we got book clips going on, everything's just running around like crazy. And it all starts with 90 minutes of Suspense Radio right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong.
Thank everybody for joining us again on this Saturday morning on Suspense Radio. It is a pleasure to welcome everybody and have, and I want to jump right in right now to our first guest, author Mary Jane Clark, like I said, author of the Wedding Cake Mystery Series. Her second book in that series, The Look of Love, is just being released. So, Mary Jane, we want to thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, John. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate that.
Yes, yeah, so like I said, your Wedding Cake Mystery Series, book two, the first book in the series was To Have and to Kill. Maybe that's what all marriages end up being, or actually, if you watch the ID channel, that's what they end up being. So, The Look of Love, can you tell everybody a little bit about the book and a little bit maybe about the series of how it progressed and the little behind the scenes of it?
Absolutely. Well, basically, The Look of Love is my 14th book, and the first 12 books I'd set in a network newsroom atmosphere because I had worked at CBS News for almost 30 years. So I set up a world where the characters go out and cover their stories, and what they get involved in leads to mystery and suspense. So that was a little bit edgier series. And while I was working on the 12th book in that Key News series, I was watching television one morning, and Martha Stewart was on promoting her book about wedding cakes. And each cake in the book was a mini masterpiece and totally mesmerizing. And I was so intrigued by these wedding cakes that I went out to the store and bought the book. And as I went through the book, I saw how each wedding cake was keyed to the different location of the wedding. So, for example, a wedding cake that was going to be for a beach wedding the cake was festooned with seashells and sand dollars. And I started to think, how about if I came up with a wedding cake mystery series where I had a young wedding cake designer who would go to different weddings in different locations, and mysteries and suspense would develop there. So, as you said, the first one was To Have and to Kill, and this next one is The Look of Love. And basically, my main character is a young woman named Piper Donovan, who is an actress. but has a lot of time between her acting roles. She's a struggling actress, and she decides to help her mother because, for reasons I won't get into, but her mother needs some help in her bakery. And Piper goes and helps her, and that's how she gets involved in the wedding cake making. But at the same time, she's also trying to be an actress and going on auditions and doing commercials and that sort of thing. So she straddles both worlds. And in The Look of Love, Piper goes to Los Angeles to do the wedding cake for someone who owns a very exclusive spa and plastic surgery center. And you can imagine there's lots of opportunities for things to get cut up, shall we say.
So that, and that's one of the things. So, because your character, Piper Donovan, and the way that you explained it, you basically thought of the idea first, and that's one thing that I always like to explore, is kind of the chicken or the egg. And some people create the characters and then they wrap the stories around them, but you went ahead and, but with the help of Martha Stewart, you designed the, basically the plot or the series, and you went ahead and then you fit the characters into that. Was that something that was new for you with your writing, because you do have so many books out? Was that kind of a new style where you did that, where you did it that way? Or is that kind of how you have been doing it for this many years?
Well, that's a good question, John. And as you ask it, I realized that for the first series, the Key News series, I created a world, a television news world, and then I populated it with my characters. And I guess I've done the same thing here. I've created a world of the wedding cake, the wedding cakes and the weddings and all of that, and then I've come up with my characters. Piper, basically, the idea for Piper came because my daughter is an actress, and I see how it is for her that she'll have a part, and then there's time before another part, and I realized that it's good to have other things to do besides acting. And so that's what I was thinking of when I created Piper. But for me, it's very important to understand the world of the book, you know, the setting of the book. And then the characters come from that. It's the whole creative process is really an organic thing, for at least for me it is. So, you know, there isn't an exact outline to follow in, you know, what I do first. It just, things just seem to develop.
And I think that a lot of, and every author definitely has their own style of how they write and how, the way that they either outline, some do, some don't. And I always just find that kind of fascinating how you, because you're basically starting with a blank page and you have to create something out of all that. And it's just amazing how many different authors have those kinds of different ways to do it.
Go ahead. No, I think you're exactly right. You know, I've heard writers say that they pretty much spend more time on the outline of the book than they do on the actual writing, because by the time they've outlined it as intricately as they want to, the writing kind of does itself. But for me, I find that I have to know who my characters are first, and beyond setting up, say, the wedding cake mystery world, I have to know who's in that world and what they do. And the more that I know who they are, which usually takes me the first, say, 75 to 100 pages of the book, once I know who they are, I know what they'll do. But I can't really write about what they'll do before I knew who they are. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. In interviewing many different authors, I mean, it makes a lot of sense just from knowing kind of, like I said, like how their plan of attack sort of goes, and they're all different in what they do. But the one thing that they always find curious, and I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Mary Jane Clark and speaking about her book, The Look of Love, which is the second in her Wedding Cake Mystery series. And you mentioned, of course, Piper, your main character, Piper Donovan, is the main character in the book. But the one thing that I always find from authors is it's that secondary character, the one that kind of snuck up on you when you were writing the book, and was almost like, when you finished it, like, I had no idea that this character was going to be either that much fun to write or that much difficult or have that big of a role. Was there a character in this book that kind of jumped out of you like that?
Yeah, there actually were two of them that I did. When I started writing the book, I didn't think they were going to be characters that really played that much into the mystery. But then as I started to write them, I just found them more and more interesting, and different things occurred to me. And so I totally understand what you're saying. In this book, The Look of Love takes place, as I said, in Los Angeles. And you always think of a Los Angeles as, you know, Hollywood and glamour and sunshine and palm trees. But while I was out researching for the book, I came across a little cloistered convent, which is, when you stand on the road in front of it, it looks like it's right underneath the Hollywood sign. And
yeah,
that whole juxtaposition of Hollywood and the glamour and a star power and all of everything physical about Los Angeles, as juxtaposed against the spiritual life of these nuns in the convent, that juxtaposition fascinated me. And I ended up writing a character of a nun who lives in the cloistered convent that somehow gets involved in the story. And at one point, I even was thinking of making her the murderer, but I figured I couldn't quite go that far. After all my years at Catholic school, I couldn't make the nun be the killer. But I didn't realize that she was going to be such a big part of the story, and I loved writing about her. So, as you say, sometimes you're surprised by these secondary characters and what they turn out to be.
And in the book, The Look of Love, which is the latest one that we're talking about here, is there one in particular scene that you kind of look back at now and say, I really nailed that scene? That's kind of the essence of the book, that when you're reading it as a reader, to grasp that, that's kind of the one, and you don't have to give specific details, but that's kind of the one place where maybe everything gets wrapped up together with the whole story, is like in this one, you know, main scene.
Well, I don't know if I could say that, because so many, with the exception of the climax of the book, the end of the book, then everything gets wrapped up. But there isn't one scene, one chapter within the book that, you know, wraps up the whole story. At the end, I spend a lot of time on the ends of the books that I write, because I want it to be super suspenseful at the end, and that you're just turning the pages and one thing leads to another, and people that aren't, you know, not Piper and not the killer. Piper and the killer will always be together, but there are other people that are going around that could be coming to Piper's defense and aid, and they won't make it in time. And I want you to be just like rooting for Piper to, you know, save herself and solve the mystery and live. But in that back and forth at the end, all of the other challenge is to make sure that everything comes together story-wise, so that all of the loose ends are also revealed, and that when you finish that final page, you're like, I'd want the reader to be out of breath, but also very satisfied.
And looking back, and a lot of people, they can find you here by going to MaryJaneClark.com, and your website is, you know, fascinating. There's many different things that people can find out about you, which is always good. So a lot of authors sometimes don't give as much information as you do, and I always thought that's a mistake. But there's one thing that people might notice if they've not read one of your books, is some of the reviews that I've noticed and that I've seen, and just from reading, is that you're very much, they say, an Agatha Christie-style writer, but with a thriller kind of edge. Do you find that fair to yourself? Do you think that that's, was that a good explanation of your writing for people that might not have not, you know, found you out yet?
Well, I consider that a huge compliment to be compared to Agatha Christie. I think that's wonderful. I I know that what we do in common is have suspects that all have a motive. And so that you're reading the book and you're thinking, oh, is it this one or is it that one, or is he the guilty party, or does she want to, you know, hurt Piper? And so I'd like to write it that all of my suspects have a motive, and that you, as you read the book, you get the clues that lead you to figure out at the end, hopefully, who the killer is. But I also like to write the book in a way that all the clues are presented, but as you read them, you might read right over them. You don't even know that what you're reading is a clue until you get to the end, and when everything else is revealed, you sit back and say, oh, hi, it was there all the time, but I just didn't see it. How did I miss that? And that's what I really like to do, because that's the kind of book that I like to read.
And so Agatha Christie is one of the books that you, or she's one of the authors that you did kind of read and maybe did style a little bit after, because it's what you read, and when you read things over and over again, that's kind of how you formulate yourself as an author when you do decide to write. And I can definitely see the aspect in there, because I've read almost everything she's ever written.
Right.
Because I love Agatha Christie. And it is funny, I try to stop myself from not figuring out who did it, because I like to be surprised, but you just can't help it. You can't help it.
It's like when you watch a Law and Order episode. You can't help it. Be looking at all the characters and thinking, oh, you know, I think he did it or she did it. I mean, that's part of the fun of a mystery, that you're trying to figure it out too. And as for, you know, the influences, I think you're a writer, and all of us are influenced by everything that we read. And the more you read, the better, you know, it helps you develop where you're going. I wouldn't say Agatha Christie has been my main influence. I think it's just a totality of things that I've written over the course of my life, and plus my own personal experiences, and that is the biggest influence, I think.
Well, and you have been writing for so long, so you've seen this publishing game change from day to day. Because all of a sudden with the e-books and everything that's going out there right now, and having to market yourself a lot more than in the past, maybe
right. Doing
maybe less book tours and more, I guess you want to say, I call them electronic tours,
mm-hmm.
not getting out there. How has that transition been for you, just as a person more than an author, that all this change is happening, and it's happened so fast that you're almost living in a thriller book because you have to try to catch your breath at every day?
What a great question. The publishing world has definitely changed, and it's not going back. My main thing is I hope that people continue to read. I know myself, I've gotten an iPad recently, and I spend so much time on that iPad that I can always find something, you know, to read, to look at, to search. You know, that thing is addictive, and I love it, and it's fabulous, but I don't think I'm reading as much since I got that iPad. I'm reading, but I'm not reading as many books.
Too many Angry Birds.
No, I haven't played Angry Birds, but I've heard all about it. But, you know, there's just so much fun stuff on there, and there's just so many hours of free time a day. So I just hope that people continue to read. That's the thing that worries me. But then on the other hand, I realized that when television came out, people said, oh, people aren't going to read anymore. They're just going to watch TV. And, yeah, they watched a lot of television, but they still read. So I'm hoping this same thing transpires when the electronics is just part of our life. It's still relatively new, and I think it's a novelty in some ways. So hopefully it's a novelty that's here to stay, but hopefully it will enhance, you know, that people will read more because, you know, it's easier for them to get books on their iPads or Nooks or Kindles or whatever they have. So I, you know what, it's the world has changed, but that's it. It's changed, and hopefully in the long run it'll be for the better.
And I want to remind everybody again, we are speaking here with author Mary Jane Clark, New York Times bestselling author of the Key News thrillers, talking about her latest book, The Second in the Wedding Cake Mysteries, The Look of Love. You can find out all the information on MaryJaneClark.com. And so, we just look back and everything else, and now looking forward, the one thing that I will say is that have you thought about, because a lot of authors, and I'll just mention three real fast, is Steve Barry, Lisa Gardner, Lee Child, they've all starting to write these little ebook novellas, maybe to bridge books and things like that and expand more on their characters. Is that something that you've thought about doing, maybe with one of your Terries in the Key News thrillers, or now maybe with Piper in this latest book, in The Look of Love, do a little expansion?
Well, actually, I just, right before The Look of Love came out, I wrote the original East story about Piper that kind of bridged between The First to Heaven to Kill and The Look of Love. And now I'll be doing another one that bridges from The Look of Love to Footprints in the Sand, which is the Piper Donovan wedding cake mystery that will be out next January. But I'm doing that. But each of those, those are like short stories, really, that you don't have to read to, pick up what's going on in the next book. It's just, a little novella in between. So, yeah, I've been doing that, too.
See, so you're jumping into all the fray of technology, iPad, now you're doing your own e-books. Look at this.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful time. It's a wonderful time to be an author. That's what I say.
Yeah, I think you have to embrace it, and anything that gets people to read, that's a good thing.
Right, and with the news story that just came out, I don't know if you heard, is that e-books are now to surpass $4.5 billion in sales, up from, I think, $600 million last year in 2010. So the jump has been enormous, and I think that any author like yourself, what you're doing in bridging these stories and doing these things brings a lot more depth to the character. People don't have to wait a year to see what's going on. You're able to bridge these things right then and there, and I think that adds a lot more depth to, the world that you create in your books.
Right. Yeah. And because these stories are so immediate, because you can get them so immediately, I think that part is great, because if I read a book by anyone that I love and the story is good, I want more. And how great to be able to just open up your electronic device and just instantly download it instead of waiting for the next time you go to the bookstore.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, Mary Jane, I want to thank you so much for coming on and speaking with us today about your book, The Look of Love, and we will talk with you soon. And again, just thank you so much for coming on with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Yes, thank you again. Fascinating stuff.
Okay, bye-bye now.
All right, bye-bye. So again, everybody, that was author Mary Jane Clark. You can find her out, MaryJaneClark.com, New York Times bestselling author of the Key News thrillers, with her latest book in her wedding cake mystery, The Look of Love, the second in the series. Go find everything else you can about her. Again, mystery, thriller, kind of wrapped into one. Definitely an author that if not on your bookshelf, put them on your bookshelf. And e-readers, wherever books are sold, you can find this book, The Look of Love. We are now going to transition over right now and go. And we're going to play an audio clip from an author called Gerald Last. It's the Ambivalent Corpse. You know how I have problems pronouncing things, and this is just another one. And so I want you to go ahead and listen to this, and we will be back then with our next guest in about 6 minutes, William Beck. So enjoy the Ambivalent Corpse by Gerald Last.
This clip is from The Ambivalent Corpse by Gerald Last. Chapter 1, The Ambivalent Corpse Appears. We found the corpse on a rocky stretch of beach in Montevideo, about a mile east of the harbor. pieces of the body were apportioned equally between the Graf Spee Memorial and the Holocaust Memorial, which are side by side on a grassy knoll overlooking the Rio de la Plata shore facing Buenos Aires to the south. Because of her strategic location, shared between two antithetical monuments, one to the German warship scuttled near Montevideo Harbor in 1939 and the other to the victims of Nazi genocide in World War II, the Uruguayan press named her the Ambivalent Corpse. But I'm getting ahead of myself in telling this story. Early the morning after Suzanne and I arrived in Montevideo, the capital of Uruguay, we began a long run to start adjusting to the four-hour time difference from California. Hopefully, the run would help us make up for only having had 4 hours of sleep. When dinners end at midnight, as is typical for Uruguay, people sleep as late as they can the next morning. Thus, the streets were mostly deserted. I better understood why the tradition of the siesta, or noon to 3 p.m. nap, became institutionalized in Spain and Latin America hundreds of years earlier. After walking south and east from the hotel to the Rambla as a warm-up, we ran east towards Punta Carreta at a pretty fast pace. Traffic at this hour was light. The Rambla was deserted at this hour, except for a few older folks walking their dogs. Since everybody in Montevideo lived in an apartment, the dogs were small. So were most of the people at the end of the leashes. Our run lasted only as far as the park, with the lake on our left and the Maritime Museum, the Graf Spee Monument, and the Holocaust Memorial on our right. Beyond the museum was the Rio de la Plata. Far out of sight across the river was Argentina. Suzanne and I were the only live people visible anywhere in this area. It was impossible not to see the pieces of dead body lying by the two memorials, so we stopped and checked things out. Pieces of body were apportioned half and half between the Graf Spee Memorial and the Holocaust Memorial. The victim was a young woman who had almost certainly been murdered. The book is available from Amazon, Apple, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, and most other e-reader formats. The best biography of me is floating around is on my author page on Amazon. I hope you all enjoy the book. Good night.
Glamour, celebrity, and murder. Whether you're looking for mystery or suspense, you'll find it all at Thriller Fast. Open to readers, aspiring writers, and published authors. Learn craft, meet top thriller writers, and enjoy New York City, July 11th through the 14th. Jack Higgins, R.L. Stein, Lee Child, Karen Slaughter, Catherine Coulter, Richard North Patterson, John Sanford, and Rule, and more. Join them this summer. Find out more at www.thrillerfest.com.
I feel like today, today, look.
Well, welcome back, everybody. And again, I want to remind everybody that we spoke with author Mary Jane Clark and talked about her latest book, The Look of Love. And we just heard from Gerald Last in The Ambivalent Corpse and his audio file. So it looks like William Beck has just joined us here. So we're going to take another quick two-minute break, and we will be right back on here with William. So in that time, hold on 1 second, everybody. We'll be right back. So I want to thank you again. We are back, and we are now joined by author William Beck. You can find out more information with him by booksbybeck.com, and his latest book is called Caribbean Agenda. It's a Brian McGann novel. So, William, we want to thank you for joining us here on the show. How are you doing today?
John, I'm doing great. I really appreciate you having me on the program. I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, and Caribbean Agenda is, like I said, it is now the it's the third book in the Bryson McGann novel. And can you tell everybody a little bit about Caribbean Agenda, kind of maybe how Bryson has, you know, progressed going here through the books from Harp's Fury through Red Seven and now into Caribbean Agenda? Give a little inside background information that everybody likes to know about.
Sure, absolutely. Well, Bryson McGann, my character, works for the National Earth Sea Science Agency based in Seattle, Washington. And he is an assistant projects director there, and NESA, the National Earth Sea Science Agency, is sort of a takeoff on NOAA, the National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration. And Bryson McGann, at the beginning of the book, finds himself, along with some others from NESA, in the southern Gulf of Mexico, exploring a deep water reef that actually exists called Pulley Ridge. And there, McGann discovers the body of a young woman, and she bears a striking resemblance to the sister of his good friend, Joe Canton, who also works at NESA headquarters. Mm-hmm. And the book leads into McGann becoming involved in a situation that deals with human trafficking, and it's an issue that I really wanted to touch on in one of the books that I did because it's such an important issue, and so many people out there are unaware of what exactly is going on with this tragic situation, not only in the Caribbean Basin, but also worldwide. And it's a fact that approximately 1 million people a year go missing worldwide, and it is just very tragic. And it takes women, children, men, doesn't discriminate in that. And it's, you know, especially if you have a family who has lost a loved one due to this, I can't imagine how difficult that must be for them. But so we get to see McGann progress through the books. And in this book itself, we get to see Bryson McGann's darker side, if you will. He's a former special ops member of the United States Army, and very intelligent individual. And so he is on the hunt along with Joe Canton to find Canton's sister before time runs out. And so their quest takes them through the Caribbean and on into Central America and finally on to Singapore.
And now when you're writing about a topic like, you know, like human trafficking, and the one story that I can think of the biggest with that was the movie Taken with Liam Neeson. And I don't think a lot of people understood exactly what was going on with that because it's such an underground topic. Did you find, You know, I mean, what kind of emotion do you go through when you're kind of researching that? Because you're going to see some really horrific stories, which, of course, are just much worse than fiction. You know, how does that make you feel when you're writing about something like that? Do you put, you know, more of yourself emotionally into a book like this and you just kind of let it all hang out? You know, like, lead us through that.
Well, it's interesting because in all the books, I do become very emotionally charged. I take on the persona of the character as I write, and as I write, I literally envision a movie playing through my head, and so that's what is transcribed onto pages. And you mentioned the movie with Liam Neeson. I did see that, but you know, interestingly, this book started off in my mind with the disappearance of Natalie Holloway in Aruba several years ago. To this day, we still don't know the answer as to what happened to this unfortunate young lady. However, from day one, I thought that she had been abducted. She was a prime candidate for that to happen. Now, will we ever know? Possibly not. And in reality, it somewhat doesn't matter because this is not only happening to her. This goes on to numerous people, and recently there's an article where someone disappeared from a cruise line, and this is something that's happened quite a few times. And so as you invest yourself in writing this book about a topic that is controversial, a topic that should be on the forefront of daily news as far as my opinion is concerned, yes, you do get very emotionally involved with this. And so I transcribe that onto the pages as we watch Bryson McGann, other side come out onto him. And it's all for good, but we see a character who has always been a no-nonsense kind of guy, but in this case, the serious nature of his friend's sister's mysterious disappearance takes on a whole new role and takes on a new aspect for his character, and it's one that my readers enjoyed very much, so in the feedback that I've received from them.
Yeah, and speaking of feedback, what's kind of like when you're writing these emotionally charged kind of books with these emotional characters, what's kind of the feedback that you normally will see from your readers, and this is, and specifically ones that had never read you before and then picked up, you know, your book, Caribbean Agenda, and all of a sudden they were like, wow, I had no idea. What kind of things do you hear from them?
Well, I've had numerous compliments from readers and other authors, and I've had comparisons to Clancy, Cussler, Koontz, Vince Flynn, some of the big writers out there on the shelf.
A couple authors that people have heard.
Yeah, I think so. So when I hear that, you know, I'm very touched. I'm very grateful for that comparison. That means a lot. You know, I've certainly read a number of each of those authors' books, and, you know, aspiring to that level is a great achievement. So I'm always happy to hear those things.
And I guess when you're sitting here and you're writing, you know, a Bryce McGann novel, and you start with Harp's Fury, Red 7, and Caribbean Agenda, when you started writing, let's go back to Harp's Fury, did you have the envision of a series going on, or was it supposed to be a one-time-only standalone where you were going to then, you know, explore different things, but you just fell in love with Bryce and you had to keep him going?
Well, you know, it's interesting because my whole idea to write started out with wanting to do children's literature. And through a number of circumstances that evolved into me reading an article about the HARP project in Alaska. And from there, the idea was spurred that this is a topic that I want to write about. And so when that thought came to mind, I created a character list, and Bryson McGann was obviously the main character, and I thought, I want to write a series on this. This is what I really want to do. Because at this point, my children were no longer younger. And so the inspiration for children's literature kind of waned. And I thought, you know, these are books, this type of genre is something I do enjoy reading, so why not get involved with that and create a character that captures people's interest and really gets them into a book. And so far it seems that I've done that with the responses I've received.
Yeah, and I guess that's the one thing that a lot of people, you know, you went ahead and you know, changed direction and really found what your, I guess you want to say, your passion and love is. And that's kind of where you show when you see an author like yourself who writes such fascinating books that you that comes through. And I guess that that's the one of the main things that people have to understand about you. And I want to remind everybody we're speaking here with William Beck. His website is booksbybeck.com. We're speaking about his latest book in the Bryson McGann series, Caribbean Agenda. So now when you look ahead and you look forward to see what's, you know, what's going on with Bryson, are we going to see another Bryson book? Are you going to step out and do something a little bit different? Kind of what does the future hold now that you kind of have these three books in the series under your belt?
Well, currently I have signed with Literary Group International, which is a major literary agency in New York City, and they have picked up my fourth book. And so we're hoping for a major publisher at this point. And I'm midway through book number five, Polar Meltdown. So, and the wheels are already spinning for book six, which usually happens. I'm halfway through a book and the next one comes to mind. So, yes, we're very much on the trail of trying to make this happen. You know, interestingly, in years past, several years ago, I had a literary agent, and after several months, I received a call from the New York State Attorney General's office and the FBI asking what my relationship was with this person, and they proceeded to tell me that she was being brought up on charges, which...
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, you got to explain that further. We got to know what you're talking about. I'd love to hear this kind of stuff.
Well, this is a true story. I won't mention the woman's name, but she was a bona fide literary agent.
Okay.
Dare I go that far?
All right.
Bona fide literary agent recommended in all the trade publications. I signed with her for my first book, Harp's Fury, and thought, well, this is great. I've got an agent, so now we'll find a publisher and we'll be on our way. And after about 8 months being with her under contract, is when I received the call from the New York State Attorney General's office saying that there were issues with her and they wanted to know what my relationship was with this woman, and I explained to them. And 2 days later, the FBI called, and we had about an hour chat on the phone, and they were asking many of the same questions, and because she was going to be brought up on charges. And she, make a long story short, she bilked people, her clients, out of $750,000. And
whoa.
Fraud, wire fraud, failure payment, and the list just goes on. So, yeah, it was a real eye-opener. It was a disappointment because I was back to square one, and so decided to just go ahead and self-publish because of this. And so that's what we did with the first three books, and we've actually had quite a bit of success. But it needs to just move on to that next point where we have a bigger distribution system and more people are familiar with the Bryson McGann series. So it's been an interesting ride.
so the big question is now, without naming, of course, you know, did you kill her off? Did you put her in a book and you killed her? Did you do it? You had to have done it. You had to have done it. You don't have to mention, you could have changed the names to save the guilty, but you could have killed her. Did you kill her?
No, only in my mind.
Oh, well, you know what? You said, like you said, you got book five and book six. You got to kill her. You got to kill her. It's kind of like the writer's revenge. It's the only revenge we got.
Maybe I'll have to write her in as a literary agent to act off Bryson McGann. But, I'm just trying to forget about her for the most part. But, it was not a fun time. But, you know, that's life. Interesting things pop up and you just deal with them.
Well, heck, and the wonder thing is maybe now you got some good connections with the FBI to kind of call and say, remember when you called me? Well, I got some interview questions for you on some research. Can you help me out here on this?
Well, it is interesting. I do have a very good friend who is with the FBI, and when when I was done with the manuscript for Harp's Fury, which is about an actual sort of black ops project in Alaska.
Yeah, I remember the Jesse Ventura conspiracy theory. One of his episodes was on that.
Right, exactly. And so there's a lot of controversy that swirls around that. And so my friend said, you know, I'd really like to have a copy of that manuscript. And I thought,
right.
You work for the FBI. It's like, are you asking me because you're a friend or?
Brad Thor mentions that too, that he has to send these things out to have them look to say, okay, we've told you certain things. Now you can't put certain things in. So they have to read it over before it gets published to make sure that he hasn't let something go that he shouldn't have.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. When we had the first book ready for mass market, it was on the Baker and Taylor list, which is a buying guide that stores use. And before it was actually available through us, there were two copies printed off, and someone purchased them. And I have no doubt it was somebody in the government checking out what to see was going on with Harp's Fury. So, yeah, it's
interesting. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know what? I think that if they're doing that, that means you're doing something right. And I think that that's the most important part, is that you're doing something right.
Well, thanks. I like to think so, and seems to be the case from reader response. And, you know, I always enjoy hearing from folks who have read the books. And, you know, and it's so important, I think, for any author to get that response from their fan base, simply because writing, if you will, quote unquote, is a lonely job. You're by yourself. And so, you know, you feel that what you're doing is good, but, you know, I don't care if you're a best-selling author. I think you want to hear that feedback from clients. It just kind of keeps you on track.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what it does. And I think that it's important, you know, to kind of keep onto that track as you're going along. And I don't know if we have lost William or not.
No, I'm right here.
Oh, there he is. Okay, good.
I didn't know if you were going to ask it to follow up with another question.
Oh, no, I was just kind of throwing that out there. But I do have a question. I do have another question, though. And it's another question that I've just started to kind of ask, and I asked our last guest. And so I want to ask you, too, because a lot of the times when you're writing a book and you have the character like you do here in Bryson McGann, there's a secondary character, though, one that kind of surprises you when you're writing that you didn't really realize is going to have this much impact in the story like they do. Is there a character in the book, Caribbean Agenda, like that for you, that secondary character that just kind of popped up out of nowhere and you're like, oh, my God, where'd this come from?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think when I write that I like to think that not one person in life does everything. And a number of books seem to lean toward that direction. I think, as with all things in life, we all need help with different things. So Bryson McGann obviously can't do it all by himself and be realistic. So, of course, there's his friend Joe Canton. But the people who pop up most to me are the characters who play the role of the bad guy, if you will, in the books. And with that, Liam Chen, who is a businessman who lives in Singapore, is a character that popped up in this book. He's an evil guy, but on the surface, he's a good guy. He's a businessman. He's well-known and respected worldwide. And I like to take these characters who pop up in the book like this and, you know, they just come to mind, and so as I'm going through the book and writing this, they come to life. They become more devious. And so those are the people that I really, really like writing about, in addition to the main characters, of course. But they're so much fun to do because everybody loves a bad guy. And so that's one of the things to me that that really stands out. It's really fun to do and helps make the storyline what it is, because Chen plays a pivotal role in Caribbean Agenda, and certainly at the end of the book, the way it's written, it's sort of a bit of a surprise ending for Liam Chen.
Absolutely. I mean, I definitely understand exactly what you're saying, because it's the bad guys, and I'm just going to talk about James Bond for a second, of course, because it's the bad guys in the Bond books that make the movie for me, mm-hmm. which is, because Bond is always, you know, who Bond is, but it's the bad guys that kind of make the story. And I think that when you're writing, your main character is your main character, but it's those bad guys, it's those villains that are going to really make the story, you know, what it is. So I definitely agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
And I think some authors, as they're starting out, make the mistake of not creating their character who is the bad guy to be able to develop him or her well enough to really capture that sense of drama that can come from those characters.
Right. Right, absolutely. I mean, I agree with that 100%. So kind of winding down here, I do have a question that, you know, I mean, it's kind of one of those little fun things, you know, just to kind of see, you know, a little behind the scenes of maybe like who you are as a person, which is, if you could sit down and you could interview one person, alive or dead, and ask them anything you wanted to find out, a secret or anything else, who would it be?
Oh, wow. Boy, that's a really great question. You know, and this is interesting because as soon as you said that, I'm going to tell you the first person that popped into my head, and that's Dwight Eisenhower. You know,
you're the first author to ever say him. I will say that.
That's interesting. You know, it really is the first person that popped into my head, so I'm going to go with that. You know, he gave us some very severe warnings in his speeches, and a lot of people don't realize the things he talked about. Part of it, the military-industrial complex. And if, you know, I'm not a conspiratorialist. However, my books swirl in that realm. So, you know, there's a bit of investigative research behind these things that deal with those type of topics. And my second book, Red 7, touches a lot on to what was said in that his last speech when he left office about the issues with the military-industrial complex and the issues that that creates. And I really encourage people to explore that speech because there was a lot of telling stuff there. But I think he was pretty much an amazing man, and this has nothing to do with what side of the political fence you're on. I mean, obviously, he was an important man. He was a general. He was a president. But I think he was also a very wise man in his dealings with life, and he certainly would have much to tell me, I think, and I have many questions for him.
Fabulous. Well, William, I want to thank you so much for coming on. Again, the book is Caribbean Agenda, the third book here in your Bryson McCann series. Your website is booksbybeck.com, and I want to encourage everybody to go out and find a little bit more about you, pick up where your books are, and again, thank you so much for coming on today, and we look forward to, you know, seeing how you have progressed in the future now that you have an agent looking for many different things and, you know, seeing what happens. You can say that you heard it here first on Suspense Radio with William Beck. So thank you, William.
Thanks so much, John. I appreciate it, and you have a great day and hope to do this again sometime.
Absolutely. Stay in touch, and we will talk with you soon.
Okay, sure will. Have a great day.
Okay. So again, everybody, author William Beck, book Caribbean Agenda. Find out booksbybeck.com for a lot more information. We are going to take our last break here of the show before we bring on author Kevin O'Brien to talk about his book, Terrified. And we are going to play another audio clip from author Bonnie Toews. And the audio clip is called The Consummate Traitor. I will say that the audio is a little bit low, so you might have to turn your radios up just a little bit to hear it, but we'll see. So here we go. The Consummate Traitor with written by Bonnie Toews.
Wednesday, March 3rd, 1943. As Sir Fletcher continued his background briefing, Lee's mind drifted over to Quinn Vargan. The last time she had seen him was almost 3 years ago. Despite the agent's professional aloofness when they worked together through Germany, Poland, and Russia, she had entrusted her soul to him. They had been as one mind and one spirit, devoid of physical coupling, and in leaving him behind, She had left a part of herself with him. That part she expected to recover when they were reunited. Instead, his apparent indifference trapped her in limbo and tripped old feelings of abandonment. What had changed? No, she corrected herself. What had heartened him so? He had become a finely honed guerrilla fighter, a killing instrument. Somewhere, during the depersonalizing process, he had lost the will to connect to his emotional center. The tapping of Sir Fletcher's pointer drew her attention back to the map. Directing its tip, he circled the Kjolan range of mountains near Rjukan in Norway. Here, he said, the Norsk hydroelectric plant. Sir Fletcher turned to face them. Rolf Halkelid, as you know, has been inside Norsk since 1938 as its chief engineer. When we've needed him to frustrate the Germans' atomic research, he has performed annoying sabotage tricks. Like what? Lee asked without thinking. Rolf lifted an eyebrow to Sir Fletcher for permission to speak. By all means, he relented. Well, one of the things I've done is drop a cup of cod liver oil into an electrolytic tube. This jams up their whole process and makes the heavy water they ship to their experimental labs useless when the researchers try to restart it. You're kidding. Cod liver oil? Lee laughed. What it loosens for humans, it constipates for science? How ingenious! She openly admired the strapping six-footer. Rolf was a Norwegian-American engineer in his mid-30s. Because of his ethnic background, he could speak Norwegian fluently and was slipped into Norway before the German occupation to build up credentials as an electronics expert and a Nazi sympathizer. When the Nazis took over Norsk, they unwittingly put in place one of Project Amanita's most strategic agents.
Glamour, celebrity, and murder. Whether you're looking for mystery or suspense, you'll find it all at Thriller Fest. Open to readers, aspiring writers, and published authors. Learn craft, meet top thriller writers, and enjoy New York City, July 11th through the 14th. Jack Higgins, R.L. Stein, Lee Child, Karen Slaughter, Catherine Coulter, Richard North Patterson, John Sanford, and Rule, and more. Join them this summer. Find out more at www.thrillerfest.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to our last segment here of Suspense Radio, where we are going to bring on New York Times bestselling author here, Kevin O'Brien, and we're going to talk about his latest book, Terrified. So, Kevin, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great, John. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm not quite as nocturnal as you. I kind of went to bed at midnight, like we just talked a little off the air. You know, we're getting you awake. We're getting you up and going because you're not used to this.
You got me up early. You got me up early. I got my coffee by me, and it's actually the sun is actually out here in Seattle. I can't believe it.
I was going to say, so you live in Seattle, first of all, so you don't see the sun a lot anyway. Then you work at night a lot, so that's another chance not to see the sun. Have you reacquainted yourself with that big old yellow thing that's in the sky?
Well, I might just be able to do it today since since I got out of bed early for you.
There you go. So, you know, Terrified, it's definitely a, you know, thriller kind of in-your-face, just, I guess, you know, terrifying thing. Tell us a little bit about, I mean, it is. I mean, you put the right freaking word on the cover. So tell us a little bit about, you know, Terrified and a little behind the scenes of why you wrote it and things of those kinds of nature.
Oh, you bet.
Why do you want to scare the hell out of everybody? Tell us that.
They got it coming. What can I tell you?
Yeah.
No. No, I actually, the type of books I write are sort of the, you know, the call came from within the house type of scary books that you grew up with when you were a teenager. So they're sort of reminiscent of that. And Terrified in particular, a occasionally my editor will give me an idea, and he'll, you know, email me and say, what do you think about such and such? And so in the case of Terrified, he said, what do you say we do a new spin on Sleeping with the Enemy, the old Julia Roberts movie? And I kind of rolled my eyes a little because I've already done an abusive husband in one of my books. So I kind of grinned and bared it and tried to come up with a new theme and new twist on it. And it's slightly different, and it, I think, goes off into its own little tangent, which is that after she fakes her own death, there's nothing about towels on the rack that have to be in order. I made sure not to do anything like that. No.
But the candle
soup
correctly.
What's that?
Yeah. You make sure the candle soup's correctly in the cabinet.
That's right. I forgot about that. I should.
Yeah.
I'm glad I didn't remember it. I would have probably subconsciously put it in there. But after she fakes her own death and leaves her husband, it turns out another woman's body is found mutilated, and they think it might be her. So her husband goes to jail for her murder, and she discovers when she flees from Chicago to Seattle that she's pregnant. And so she's not sure if she should risk her new child's safety by having an abusive dad, so she just stays quiet, stays hidden, and the action really picks up after about 15 years. It sort of flash forwards very quickly, and husband, I won't say anything else. I shouldn't say anything further except something happens to her child after a while, so when he's a young teenager. And so you really get to know this woman. You've got 13 years of hiding and looking over her shoulder, and she's always... Never comfortable. She's always on the run, and so my editor was pretty happy with what the twists and turns I took with it. And whenever he suggests something like this, I always throw in a serial killing. And in fact, it's in my contract. It doesn't say three books. It says they want three more serial killer thrillers. So there's always some sort of maniac on the loose that's doing something in addition to what's going on, and somehow the stories all tie together. So. That's Terrified in a nutshell.
And so this is kind of one of the first times I've heard. Now, of course, I've heard editors say, oh, why don't you kind of do this with your character or whatnot? But were you kind of have some reservations, but I never really heard the editor kind of say, you know, let's do a Sleeping with the Enemy kind of thing.
Right.
And but you ended up, you know, how did you feel after it was over? How do you feel, you know, what were you like with your reservations? Kind of an odd thing. I'm not really sure how to formulate a question because I've never really had to hear this, you know, from an author saying, yeah, my editor wanted me to write this kind of book.
It is. It's very funny. We have a very good working relationship. We went on vacation together a few years back, and we're walking down the street, and he goes, you know, what do you say you do something with amnesia? And I'm like, oh, my God, no. I'm rolling my eyes again. And, you know, by the time I'm done with it, I feel like I have full ownership. I'm like, that was a fantastic idea I had. I suddenly take over. But he's very patient. We kind of go back and forth. And actually, it's a great relationship as far as working together, because he gets my input. I get something from him. And I usually end up doing an outline, and it's like usually around 100 pages, so which is incredible. I mean, most people, when they find out my outlines are that long, they just are astounded. But there are no surprises when I finish the book, and because he's already seen practically a blow-by-blow description of everything that's going to be there. And
right.
So that process, once I deliver the book to him, he's always very happy. He'll have me change one or two things, and that's about it. So it's a great relationship. He's been my editor since 1996.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, you better not
leave
that
house. You're an old man.
I'm an old man. I got my first book published when I was 30. The day after my 30th birthday, I found out, you know, how you set those goals for yourself? Well, mine was to get published by the time I was 30, and I sold my first book in 1986, day after my birthday. My agent called me up, and I used to work for the railroads, and I got this call at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I was like, what the heck happened? Is it a derailment? Is it a railroad strike? What the heck? And I didn't pick up because I thought, I don't want to talk to some railroad official at 6 o'clock in the morning. So I'm listening to the message machine, and it's my agent singing Happy Birthday to me, like Marilyn Monroe singing to JFK. And,
oh,
and she said, for your birthday, I'd like to say that you sold your book, and you did. And so give me a call. And that was the start of my career as an author, and that was back in 1986.
True. And, you know, looking back, I mean, you're saying 1986, and all of a sudden now it's your 2012, and you've been through the gamut of publishing because, like we just talked
sure
with
have.
Another author, you know, Mary Jane Clark, who was just on the show earlier. You,
mm-hmm.
I mean, how has it changed? I mean, have you been able to keep up with everything that's going on? I mean, literally, you can almost say the book Terrified is exactly what authors are going through right now. They're all terrified. Know what the hell's going on? What's happening?
Yeah, it's crazy. It just doesn't stop. It's just changing and changing. And I happen to be very lucky. I think my first two books were sort of general fiction. One was called, my first sell was called Actors. And it was sort of a sweeping saga. I used to call it The Thornbirds Go to Hollywood. And it sold fairly well, and this was back in the days of Jackie Collins, and so I had lots of sex in it because that's what my agent kept telling me. She said, it's more sex, more sex. And the next one I did was called Only Son, and
you
I got
were, like, in the book or at home?
Well, I got to tell you the story connected to that.
Go ahead.
I put my... It's getting good now.
Yeah, now
Blue Radio. Suspense
it,
Radio
let's
became
go,
Blue
let's
Radio.
Roll. I need a beer. Okay, go ahead.
No, when it got published, my mother read it, and she said, you know, I kept thinking, oh, my God, is he going to do it again? Is there going to be more of the same? And she said, you know, Kevin, I usually kind of like that sort of thing, but when it's my own son, I'm a little reluctant to read this sort of stuff coming from you. And I said, well, you know, gee, Mom, do you think I should have changed my name when I wrote it? And she said, oh, no, Daddy and I will change ours, so don't worry about it. So I'm glad the whole family was ready to change their name. It was a pretty blue book, but
wow.
It did fairly well. It got published internationally as well as in the United States. And then I went on to Only Son, which had a break because I got a movie option with it. And it never got made, but Tom Hanks was going to be in the movie, and it was written by the screenplay was written by John Pielmeyer, who did Agnes of God. And it was, you know, they had all these big plans, and it went down the drain, so unfortunately. But that was,
yeah.
You know, I made those breaks. And then right after that, my agent suggested that I write a thriller because she said, you know, your stuff is sort of suspenseful. You really should go into this genre because it's a very hot genre. It's going to be easier to sell than just general fiction. And so I made the switch and wrote something called The Next to Die, and it was a USA Today bestseller right away. And they said, oh, I think we found our niche for Kevin. So I've been in that niche.
This is easy.
Yeah, but you know, it came to me pretty naturally because I was a big Hitchcock fan when I was growing up, and liked to scare myself and watch, you know, the Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Thriller and Twilight Zone and you know, I would just eat that stuff up. And so, and it's a great genre to be in now too because of the transition that's going on. Thrillers are still selling very well, and you know, I'm perfect for ebook publishing as well because, you know, a lot of people don't want to keep their copy of, you know, of Terrified right by Gone with the Wind and To Kill a Mockingbird. It's not something you're going to keep. Oh, I can't throw that out. I've got to read that five more times. Although a lot of my readers do read my books several times, so that,
sure.
Which is great news. So listen to me pump myself up.
Heck yeah. That's the fabulous thing is because you're able to make the switch. You went from Only Son, you went to The Next to Die, you kind of found your groove writing.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes.
The one thing I'm wondering when you're exploring is, and I kind of like to ask thriller writers, because your whole, you know, gamut is to make the page turn and to scare the hell out of people as you're going along.
Mm-hmm.
So do you go ahead and wonder and say, okay, first of all, what scares Kevin O'Brien? And are you able to write those things into the book as kind of a way of therapy for yourself?
Oh, I like that. That's a great question. Well, you know, it's funny. I just recently, a friend of mine said, you know, hey, you know, my beautician is also a chakra and an aura reader. And I said, okay. And she said, you know, she's trying to get her certificate or whatever the heck they do. And she said she needs more victims. So could you go to her and get a free reading? I said, sure. So I went to her and she sat me down in the barber chair and waved her hands over me and finally put her hands under my feet and said, you know, you have some cracks down here. And I said, you know, okay. And she said,
wow,
you are, she said, you're, at least I'm not cracked up there. She said,
yeah.
Said,
I mean, after you're going to do it, I'm like, wow,
here.
Thanks a lot. I just met you.
Well, she did. She said, you're a very nice guy. So she said, this is why I'm saying this. She said, you've got these, you're letting these things in, and basically I'm seeing this evil little man that's getting inside you, and he's got these horrible ideas. And she said, you're working with him on something. And I said, did my friend tell you that I write thrillers? And she said,
yeah.
No, but it makes perfect sense now. She said, I see you're letting some evil thing in to help you through something. And she said, I think you were killed in an earlier life, too, very violently, and you're working it out in your writing. So there's that theory, and it's the other theory that I just like to creep myself out, and, you know, I've always liked scary stuff. And when I'm writing, I try not to be too gory. I don't go into a lot of bloodletting. So I get far more creeped out in just something suggested. So, for example, in Terrified, I never the serial killer dismembers his victims, and you never once see
that.
Him do
I
it.
Love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, it's a good way to. But you never once see him cut a body up, you know. But it's suggested, and maybe it's my Hitchcock background, but I, you know, one of the creepiest shots in Rear Window is watching Raymond Burr wipe down the white tiles on his in his bathroom, because you
right.
know he's cut up his wife in that bathtub. And so taking that idea, all I did was show the guy's house, and that there's a clawfoot tub in the basement, and above it one of those racks that you have over an island in the kitchen, and instead of pots and pans, it's just saws and knives. And that was all you saw. And I figured that's all you need to see. It's a creepy image, and it'll stick with the reader. They don't have to see a lot of blood splurting. They just need to see that empty tub, and they know what's going on in there. So that's the kind of stuff I like to do that really creeps you out sort of artistically.
Yeah. I mean,
are you hanging
what,
up now? You're like, I don't want to talk to this psycho anymore.
No, I mean, are you kidding me? I mean, I'm fascinated by all of that, because that's the part. I'm going to say there's one line. Why we started this radio show, and so I kind of give a little background. I've told the story before, but I'll say it again because it's been probably a year and a half. The reason why we started this radio show was because of this. The movie Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield and Sam Kinison, you remember that movie,
mm-hmm.
is when Rodney Dangerfield turns in a paper to his English professor about Kurt Vonnegut, and the lady gives it back and said, I don't know who wrote this, but it surely wasn't you, and whoever did doesn't know a thing about Kurt Vonnegut. When it was Kurt Vonnegut who wrote the damn paper. So that is the reason why we started this, to be able to not let people speculate what authors are thinking, but actually what the hell you're thinking when you're doing this.
When you're doing it, exactly.
And that's why, and so this is why it's fascinating to get the behind the scenes, because as a thriller writer, what you did with that lady who was messing with your feet, you ran home, you grabbed your digital recorder and said, you're going in one of my books because you're freaking fascinating. So let's find out more about you. You know, and that's true thriller writer stuff. That's what you do. You, everyday things. You just see them in everyday little things, but you're
yes.
able to turn them into a way where people can't put their head and they can't put their mind into those kinds of situations. And that's what makes authors fascinating, to be able to have that foresight.
I agree
look.
With you. I
yeah.
totally agree with you. It is funny. That story from Back to School reminds me of I got an email from a reader who said, you know, you had somebody's license plate, and it was JOB 607, and I looked up the Book of Job in the Bible, and I saw that verse, and it just was so profound that you planted it there, blah 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 blah. And I didn't have the heart to tell him that it was just a hello, a shout out to my sister Joan O'Brien, whose birthday is June 7th. So I said, "Oh, I'm so glad you caught it. I haven't heard from anyone except you, so I'm so glad you got that that connection."
And in true author form, it's like, "Have you read my next book?"
And by the way, my new book,
what's coming out? Now the one thing
you got it.
Yeah, and now the one thing, we have never been able to catch up with you on any of the conventions and things that are out there, like Thriller Fest and things like that.
Can you believe it? We have not. We've missed. I know Boyd Morrison. I just got together with him yesterday, and he was saying, he was singing your praises, John. He was. If your ears were burning,
Boyd.
He was
fabulous. Yeah, Boyd is
great
fabulous.
Guy.
And yeah, that's right. He's from Seattle, and you guys probably do the Northwest Pacific Writers Association stuff, but we've never been up for that one. So
that's right.
I'm wondering, when you have a lot of stuff on your schedule. I want to remind everybody first that we're speaking with author Kevin O'Brien. KevinO'BrienBooks.com is his website. The book is Terrified. But you have a ton of stuff that you're doing, and you know, you're kind of in the middle of it right now, where you were just at the Seattle Mystery Bookshop. So you still go to a bunch of these things. Do you still find that that is enjoyable for you? Or is it becoming, now you're just doing, like I like to call, more electronic touring than actual in-your-face touring?
That's a great question. I still do a lot of, in-your-face touring. The electronic touring, it doesn't thrill me quite as much because you're stuck doing a lot of emails. And that sounds horrible because the emails I get are so nice, but it ends up, you know, you spend like 4 hours composing emails back, and you know, I always want to give personal responses to people. I don't want to just, you know, give them blueprint stuff. But no, I do a lot of tours. I also am, Boyd's also with them, is the Seattle Seven Writers is a group of writers here in Seattle. Well, you know, Seattle's got a ton of writers anyway. And Garth Stein, who wrote The Art of Racing in the Rain, and Jenny Shortridge, who wrote When She Flew, those are the two different books from them. They started the Seattle Seven Writers about 3 years ago, and it was just to sort of help literacy and help reading in schools, and you know, just to elevate literacy in the Pacific Northwest. And so now we've got originally we're seven of us, and I'm one of the quorum members, but now we have, I think, about 50 members, including Tom Robbins and Eric Larson and Elizabeth George, who's just
Eric Larson, we just interview him for the magazine. He's going to be in May or June. Yeah, a fabulous writer.
Oh, isn't he great? He's a really terrific guy. Very funny. It's, you know, some of the more gruesome stories they write, I think the funnier they are. John Saul's also very funny.
We know John Saul too. Yeah, we've talked to him many times.
Yeah, in fact, he was one of the people who helped me get started in my career. Once I'd published that first book, he was very, very. He and Terry Brooks were very, very helpful to me. They were like my
Terry
mentors.
Terry Brooks, a science fiction writer.
Yes. Yeah.
Look at that.
So, yeah,
look at you name dropping.
Look at just. Oh, did I drop a name? I'm sorry.
Yeah, so here's the kind of thing, because people that are new to your writing and they don't really know, you know, they might just be finding out, getting into the thriller genre, you're getting new fans. Besides Terrified, which is your latest book, which one would you let people know and say, you know what, I would like you to start with this one first to kind of maybe get the sense of who I am, you know, starting out as a writer, because now, of course, you've expanded yourself, but this is the book you should start with, and then you can kind of move on.
Well, you know, I love how you know what authors are required to say right away is, oh, it's definitely my latest one. You have
I
to
know,
check out
I'm not
Terrified.
Stupid.
I know
how
you
did. Up for you.
Don't you
to
give me this Terrified
you.
Business.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just. But I would say since I've written 13 books and they're all standalone, so I don't have part of a series, so you don't have to start with anyone in particular. I would say it wasn't one of my bestsellers, but I really liked Vicious. I thought Vicious had a lot going for it, and it was my original idea. It was not suggested by my editor, and I came up with it and came up with a interesting storyline and everything else. And I really liked that particular book. It's about a a serial killer known as Mama's Boy. Not to get too the stuff. I can't believe I get these ideas. I creep myself out.
Yeah, really.
It's that little man. You know, he's working overtime sometimes. And
that's
it's
because
about a serial
you stay
killer
up too damn late at night. That's the problem.
Well, that's it. That's it. Mm-hmm. It's you know, I write while others sleep, and it's actually it's a great time to write too because
right.
You know the phone's not ringing, you don't have a lot of distractions, and it's almost you're in the mood for something kind of creepy. It's almost like turning off the lights to watch a scary movie. I have a little converted Murphy bed closet that has a window that has a view of the Space Needle, and it's a beautiful little office, and I sit in there and just write, and occasionally I will creep myself out to the point where I get a little scared myself. I'm fair for vicious.
Yeah.
I had a very scary scene that I wrote, and I finished it. I just finished it, gave myself the goosebumps, and got up to get something and realized my front door was open, and it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. So I grabbed I think it was a meat tenderizer in my kitchen.
Really? A meat
tenderizer?
And
went around and looked. I was looking around the closets and behind the curtains and everything else to make sure that no one had gotten in. And I guess it's like an idiot. I just left the door open, but I was convinced I was a goner. I was, you know. So
there
but
you
I
go,
here,
audience. He can write thrillers, but when it's into his face, he grabs a meat tenderizer, and I guarantee you, not one character in any one of your books ever grabbed a meat tenderizer to try to get an assailant.
It's almost like something out of a dream, you know. Oh, I grabbed a dolphin and beat somebody to death with it. You know, it's like what
a meat tenderizer?
What the hell? In fact, I told that story to somebody. And they said, "You had Lori's seasoning salts with you?" And no, what hammer?
I threw it in the face. I know.
Yeah, I like that. Like, yeah. Just like mace, except in granular form.
Right. They roughed him, but he smelled good.
It sounds like something out of the Seinfeld where Kramer was in the butter or whatever it was, that he was basted in butter.
Absolutely.
Tasted like a turkey or something. I forgot what it was.
Well, I'll tell you, Kevin, I want to thank you so much for coming on. Time has just flown by. I don't know if you're through your coffee yet, but at least your day is starting. And now you're able to get up and see what Seattle looks like in the daytime.
I know. This is amazing.
And
this
I've never been there. I've never been to Seattle, but I'll tell you what.
Oh, you've got to get out here, John.
I would love to come up for the Pacific Northwest Writers Conference, which is happening like right after Thriller Fest. And I know that and Virgin has some cheap flights going to Seattle, so it might be something that we might have to try to do because we were trying to go last year and that didn't work out. But I would probably email them and, you know, get some press passes to come up and see everybody.
God, they'd love to have you. Are you kidding me? And there are so many thriller authors there, too. We, you know, Seattle, along with Rain, we have a lot of writers. So.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You got. I mean, that's where Grunge came from. That's where thrillers come from. I mean, what are you going to do? Washington and Maine. I don't get it. I don't get Washington and Maine. That seems to be the two states that they all live. And third would be Colorado.
And I heard Minneapolis has got a lot of writers, too, for some reason.
Yeah,
or maybe it's got a lot of readers. Yeah.
But you know why? Because we used to live in Minneapolis, and it's so damn cold, there ain't much to do but read or write for 6 months out of the year.
I think that's it, too. I think it's the same way with Seattle.
Yeah, I think per capita they have the most iPad sales of any city in the United States.
Wow.
I technically just made that up, but it sounds good because it is so damn cold that people would be inside playing with their iPads. But you know what?
I love those people who make up their own facts. I think that's great.
I just made that up. But at least I told people I made it up instead of making believe it. Well, I'll tell you, Kevin, we got a roll. And again, we want to thank you so much for coming on. You're welcome anytime. Stay in touch, and we will talk with you soon.
Oh, thank you, John. It's been great.
All right, you have a good day.
Take care.
All right, bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is author Kevin O'Brien, and the book is Terrified. KevinO'BrienBooks.com is his website to find out any information you want to do, find any information you want on Kevin. He's written many different thriller books, one of the top in the field right now. When you read it, you can't put it down. It just goes from page to page. And if you're scared, put a meat tenderizer next to you while you're reading the book, just in case somebody jumps out, because that's what Kevin does when he gets scared. Just remember, he grabs a meat tenderizer. So again, everybody, we want to thank Mary Jane Clark for coming on the show, and MaryJaneClark.com, and then William Beck, books by Beck.com, to talk about their latest books. And our April issue is being released today, so check your email for all of that. If you want to hear your audio clip here on the radio, simply email editor@suspensemagazine.com, and we will get it on in an upcoming show. If you want any more information, you can email us also about what's going on. We are off now to go interview Nick Santora. He is one of the head writers for what was Prison Break and Lie to Me, and the creator, co-creator of the show Breakout Kings. He wrote a book called 15 Digits. That interview is going to be in the May edition of the magazine, and he lives here in Los Angeles, so we're going to go meet him and speak with him right now. So, everybody, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Check out SuspenseMagazine.com, Suspense Radio, to see the lineup we got coming up, because it is going to be fascinating. You want 4 free issues? You know what to do. Email us, find us on Facebook, Twitter, anywhere else you want to do. Check out your favorite authors. We will talk to you guys later. We are back on April the 28th for our next show. So until then, have a good one. Enjoy yourself. Goodbye.